everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Patrick Hayes about his new book, The Civil War Diary of Reverend James Sheeran, CSSR, Confederate Chaplain and Redemptionist. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by... Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Patrick Hayes about his new book, The Civil War Diary of Reverend James Sheeran, CSSR, Confederate Chaplain and Redemptionist. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I am a Northerner, so I was born in Massachusetts. I am hardly one to have sympathies with the Confederacy, so engaging with Father Sheeran has been something of a challenge for me, but an eye-opener. I have been schooled in the ways of church history going back maybe a decade or so. I work as the archivist for the Redemptorist Fathers. They are a religious order of Catholic priests and brothers, founded by St. Alphonsus in 1732. And their order came to the United States in 1832 to serve mostly German Catholics in the country.
Could you explain exactly what the Redemptorists are? Because they loom large in Sheeran's life, of course, and they are distinct from Catholics in a few ways. And I was wondering if you could explain why it was that, you know, the ways in which they differ from other different, schools of Catholicism, and also what it was that drew Sheeran to them.
Sure. Redemptorists, when they first arrived, they were invited over at first to minister in Detroit. There was a cluster of Germans there who lacked a German-speaking priest. And so the Bishop of Detroit invited the Redemptorists who were in Europe to come to the United States and establish a mission. The Germans were growing all the time, mostly in urban areas along the coastline, but also in the interior of the country. But by the time the six Redemptorists arrived in New York and made their way out to Detroit, the bishop had died. And so when they arrived, the administrator of the diocese had no idea that they were on their way, and so suggested that they go up into the Michigan Thumb to check on the native peoples who were there to see if there were any Catholics left. The Redemptorist said, okay, we're missionaries, let's go. So up they went, and they first ministered to the Chippewa, those Catholics that they found in Upper Michigan. And they did this for about 6 years before they started wondering if this was really the purpose of their ministry. They were thinking more along the lines of returning to Austria, where they came from. But as fate would have it, one of the bishops in the United States, Michael O'Connor of Pittsburgh, had a German church, German-speaking church, that needed German-speaking clergy. And so he made an offer to those Redemptorists who were ministering in Michigan to come out to Pittsburgh and start the first Redemptorist parish of St. Philomena's in Pittsburgh. And gradually they spread throughout the country, wherever there were Germans, mostly in urban areas. So they began parishes in Baltimore, in New York, in Buffalo, Rochester, it's so on and so on. And gradually their numbers increased. They had a number of vocations. And eventually they took in even an Irishman like James Sheeran.
What was it that drew Sheeran to the Redemptorists as opposed to some other aspect of Catholicism?
Well, these priests had a real gift for relating with people. St. Alphonsus was known as an excellent pastor, always going to people who were sort of on the margins. But they also had a very rigorous theology behind them. Even today, St. Alphonsus is known as the patron saint of moral theologians. And, you know, moral theology can be very tangled and kind of a thicket. But when Sheeran encountered them, he was a married man. And his life prior to this encounter, I think, is worth exploring a little bit. So Sheeran was born in County Longford in Ireland in January 1817. We don't know when exactly he came to North America, and we don't know who accompanied him or what his point of entry was. We think it may have been through Canada. But we figure in his early teens, he made the journey, whether alone or with someone else. And eventually, as a young man, he ended up in New York City. And there he got himself more or less an education, not only on the street, but in the church. So much so that the local pastor at St. Mary's Church on Grand Street in Manhattan employed him as a catechist. Gradually, he became older, he matured, and he met a woman named Margaret. We don't know her last name, but they got married, and eventually they had three children. Now, the story of Sheeran's family life is a little bit complicated, but it's also very sad. In order to make his fortune, he decided to take his bride out of the city and into a place called McConnellsburg, Pennsylvania, which looks an awful lot like County Longford in Ireland. Very lush and green, but also heavily, heavily populated with Catholic folks, most of which were Irish. So he decided to stay there for several years. And he had good neighbors, including the Hughes family. And I mention them only because one of the boys in the Hughes family, John, grew up to be the Archbishop of New York during the Civil War. So he was familiar with prominent Catholics, even though they were sort of still in their infancy. But McConnellsburg was kind of a farming community, and Sheeran had greater ambitions. So by this time, he took his bride and his youngest daughter, Isabella, or actually his oldest child, Isabella, and the family removed themselves to Monroe, Michigan. And it's in Monroe that Sheeran first encounters Redemptorists. These priests had taken on a little country church and were chaplains to a growing community of women religious. So these sisters, the sisters servants of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, were a beginning order, but they grew in great numbers. They had several thousand over the course of the last century and a half. And their primary function was to be school teachers. So in Monroe, there was a little schoolhouse, and the sisters taught in the schoolhouse. And quite on a lark, and at the suggestion of the Redemptorist pastor, they hired this young man to teach in the school. Now, at this time, say 1850s, Sheeran's family was growing, number one. Isabella was followed by John, and then a toddler, Sylvester. And unfortunately, Sylvester did not survive his toddlerhood. He died very, very soon after being born. But also during this time, being Catholic in Michigan was not all it was cracked up to be. The Know-Nothing movement in that state was very active. And as an Irishman with a very short temper, when you assault someone for their beliefs, Sheeran was the kind of person who could respond in kind. And so not only was he the local school teacher, but also kind of a lawyer and advocate. He wrote editorials against Know Nothings. He lobbied in the state legislature against their pieces of legislation that would curb Catholic education. And so he really made a name for himself, which I have to say really endeared him to the Redemptorists, who were the owners of the school.
This part of his life is really interesting. I was wondering, did this push him both toward taking up the cloth himself? You know, basically that by defending the faith as often as he became more invested in it? And did it also end up pushing him politically towards the opponents of the Know Nothings, the Democrats, which at this time were the pro-immigration party that tend to be more welcoming of the Irish?
Well, certainly as an immigrant himself, he had sympathies for people who were fleeing Europe for various reasons, either war or poverty or both. And the fact that America presented itself as being open not only to new populations, but to ideas. This is something that really appealed to Sheeran and something he wanted to participate in. However, it's a bit tricky to say that he had a vocation other than to be a good father. Now, after the death of his youngest child, Sylvester, unfortunately, his wife passed away. So Margaret is now out of the picture. And that suddenly left him as a widower with two growing children, Isabella and John. So as they were going through their own maturation, Sheeran asked his local pastor, you know, do you have any additional work for me so that I can help support my family? And frankly, he sort of eased himself more and more into church work, which does not pay well. so he was told by the pastor, you know, it seems to me that you have a vocation that we're just not prepared to meet. Let the children grow, care for the kids, and then we'll see where we are in a few years' time. So this is exactly what Sheeran did. He was a very good father to his youngest, to his two children. But by the time John was around 13 years old, he had reached a point where he could be placed in a boarding school. And so he was packed off to St. Vincent's Abbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where the Benedictines have a large abbey in school. Now, almost immediately after he arrived, he died. Poor John, the records of his life are so sparse. We only know anything about him through Sheeran. In part because the Benedictines in Latrobe have had a series of fires in their abbey, and most of their records from the 19th century have gone up in smoke, that we don't even know where John is buried. So that left Isabella. And Isabella, probably his favorite child, because he knew her the longest and the best, she was placed with the Immaculate Heart of Mary sisters in Monroe. Initially, they accepted her as a student, and gradually she found her own vocation as a sister. Unfortunately for Isabella, the very first assignment that she was given was to go out to Pennsylvania to start a new mission there. And within 3 years, she died too. So now, Sheeran was completely free of family responsibilities. He could finally enter into religious life himself.
And when does he do this?
He becomes a Redemptorist in 1855. And actually, he has a very good novice master in a man named Francis Silos, who is now a candidate for sainthood. Silos shows up in his life only periodically, but the excellent training that he received from this holy man made him an excellent priest. He was ordained in 1858.
And where was he first assigned?
Well, he goes on his first assignment to a parish in the Irish Channel in New Orleans. And this parish is kind of a unique place because it's actually three parishes in one. So the Redemptorist controlled an area called Ecclesiastical Square, and very large territory included a German church, an Irish church, and a French church. And the German and Irish churches are on the same street, just across the street from one another. So Sheeran joined Father John Duffy, another Irishman, and the first pastor of St. Alphonsus Church. But they all lived, both Irishmen and Germans, they all lived under the same roof. But I have to say, Sheeran was not fond of Germans. So when Father Duffy was transferred, he came up to Annapolis periodically over the course of his career. When he was transferred, Sheeran was the only Irishman left in the house, and he really had a hard time. So that by 1860, when the Archbishop of New Orleans came calling, asking for volunteer chaplains for the Civil War, Sheeran's hand shot up immediately. He said, "Get me out of this house as soon as you can." It didn't take very long for the transfer to take effect. I think the Germans kind of had it up to their own eyeballs with Father Sheeran. And so very early in the war, Sheeran went off to Camp Pulaski outside of Baton Rouge for his training and assignment.
So what was his role in the army during the Civil War? And how exactly did he conceive of his role? Because it's a very fascinating issue, this idea of religion. And as you've outlined it, here's a person whose association with the South is a relatively recent one. And yet here he is, and this is something that comes across very clearly in his diary, has really embraced this cause and seems rather quite passionate about it.
Oh, definitely. The parish where he got his first assignment, St. Alphonsus in New Orleans, St. Alphonsus is the Irish church and was an enormous success almost from the beginning. The Irish who built this church, they dug the foundations themselves. They put in sweat equity brick by brick, and they really built a magnificent structure. So that by the time Sheeran arrived there, the Redemptorists had very little work to do. But the most pressing demand was to build a school. So Sheeran was given the job of building the first boys' school for the Irish children. And I have to say, when you care for the children of families who are trying to make something great, you are one of them. They adopt you. So Father Sheeran had a great love of St. Alphonsus and of New Orleans. And more broadly, he really respected and honored all of their hard work because it was for God's glory. By the time he was a Civil War chaplain, it's kind of ironic, he was assigned to a Polish regiment. That Polish regiment did not last very long. The 14th Louisiana was kind of an amalgamation of this Polish unit, but also several Irish units from New Orleans, including his own parish of St. Alphonsus. So he knew a lot of the men who volunteered to serve, and he became their parish priest.
So he views the, you know, these units as his parish, and he travels with them throughout the war. And his interaction with them, which is one of the things that really flavors his diaries, is one in which they are respectful of him, but at the same time, they treat him in many ways as an equal.
Oh, yes. And, you know, Irishmen, they give as good as they get. So some of the more humorous episodes in the diary include one where Father Sheeran comes upon a group late at night. They're sort of relaxing, and they're trying to pass the time by playing cards. And so Sheeran's stature, he's only about, we think, maybe 5'2", 5'3". He's a short little guy. And if he was dressed in his clericals, he would have been dressed in black. And if he had a hat on at all, he would have had a black beretta. So coming upon a group of men around the campfire, all dressed in black, he was sort of stealth personified. So he came up behind them, and he noticed that all of these men had a considerable pot of money in front of them. Now, card playing was forbidden in camp. And so all Sheeran needed to do was creep up behind them, snatch the money, wag his finger, and say, "Boys, for your penance, I'm giving this money to the orphans."
So,
and of course, the natural response, any good Irishman knows, it's "Yes, Father."
"You beat us to it, Father." And yet they didn't seem to hold that against him, at least not as we read in his diary. In fact, there seemed to be some no small amount of affection for him among many of the men.
You know, that's true. And spiritually, that kind of rapport went a long way. He had it publicized in the Richmond newspapers that the money that he swiped from these unsuspecting soldiers actually went to the Sisters of Charity orphanage in Richmond as a Christmas present. So the only thing that Sheeran asked in return is that the orphans pray for the health and welfare of the soldiers.
So he seems to have a kind of a roving commission in a lot of ways, because he does a lot of travel. Oftentimes you have presented passages where he's riding on his own on a horse. He definitely listens to the men around him, because as you describe, sometimes they end up saving his life and prevent him from being shot at. But but he really does have he's not in a specific chain of military command, and so he has a lot of latitude that you wouldn't necessarily expect someone who is serving with a army, you know, at war.
Well, and I have to say, having become intimately acquainted with this man, I'll just lay it on the line. He's very arrogant. And a classic example of this is related to his travels or his ability to travel. So you couldn't move anywhere in wartime without a pass. Your commanding officer was constantly being hounded for passes to go here or there. And for a chaplain, it was especially difficult, because sometimes you had to go where passes could not be issued. So he had become so fed up with the process that one day he explained to another priest colleague of his, "Look, let's just go get the ultimate pass. So he marches off to an encampment where Robert E. Lee, the head of the Confederate forces, was at the time planning out the Battle of the Wilderness. And so you have to go through several layers of officers in order to get to Lee. But this little priest managed to, like a battering ram, run the gauntlet and finally approaches Lee's tent. He barges into the middle of a meeting and demands a pass. He's very explicit about how he phrased this. And at first, Lee was very taken aback, didn't know who this man was or how he got there. And probably after a little while of listening to this diminutive priest ask for a pass, Lee probably said to himself, I better just give this man what he wants so he can get out of my hair. So Lee capitulates. He grants him the universal pass, but not without a little caveat. He said, you know, Father Sheeran, not even my highest-ranking officers get a pass like this. And not to be outdone, Sheeran retorts that as a Catholic priest, even I outrank you, General Lee. So he got the pass, and off he went, chuckling under his breath. But that kind of arrogance, I think, served him well. In part because he used the pass to do some fairly amazing things under some very dire circumstances.
One of the things that he had another sort of pass in a way, which was his profession, because as you described, sometimes he would be, you know, through his interactions with the church, be interacting with people who were involved with the Union. I was thinking of this one passage in particular where he's in Maryland and he goes up to a, I think it's a nunnery, and the head sister comes out and talks to him and basically says that I can't really talk to you anymore because we have Union officers here. And if I talk to you for too long, they might think I'm conspiring with the enemy. And how it, and I thought that really captured the degree to which that there was a fluidity that his occupation as a Catholic chaplain gave him that oftentimes transcended or complicated the straight Union Confederate boundaries that we oftentimes read about when it comes to the war.
That's right. His own view of the conflict is in itself complicated. Here he is, someone who was placed in New Orleans and ministered, by all accounts, very well to a certain ethnic group, and almost none of whom had any political leanings other than, you know, they were desirous of freedom. For Sheeran, his own politics were sort of taken up in the question of states' rights. And so for him, the Civil War was not so much about slavery, although I will confess, some of the passages related to people of color are less than kind and, frankly, quite bigoted. But in the idiom of his day, He was less concerned about the status of slaves and more concerned about the preservation of the Union. And this, he thought, could only be done through a kind of scrupulous observance of the Constitution and the rights of states to self-determine. The love for people in the North is hardly in evidence. And so when he encounters prisoners of war from the Union side, the Federals, he's constantly trying to convert them to you know, his own way of thinking. But even beyond that, when certain bishops or other Catholic clergy present themselves as being pro-union or even pro-Confederate, Sheeran is not so much inclined to talk politics with them, but he is under the assumption that they're people of goodwill and they can be persuaded. You find this with an encounter between Sheeran and a prisoner of war who asks him if he knew Archbishop Hughes' own views on the war. Now, Hughes had by this time become the Bishop of New York and was staunchly pro-Union. This is a former neighbor of his from his days in Pennsylvania. And so Sheeran was like, yes, I know quite well John Hughes' own position, but he's wrong. Now, naturally, I think if the Archbishop of New York knew of Sheeran's feelings, he would be, you know, equally vociferous in his denials that he was wrong. But it just goes to show you that the clergy knew one another's views quite well. They read the papers just like everybody else.
And yet, unlike so many Protestant denominations, and for obvious reasons, the Catholic Church never split. So they oftentimes had to cohabitate and engage in a level of cooperation that was very much at odds with the climate of the time. You have so many schisms happening in terms of culture, in terms of society, that ultimately the political schism. And yet you have a Catholic Church in which you do have the big tent in which both views are represented.
Yeah, and it's actually no small miracle that Catholics after the war really were a kind of bomb on the Union. You know, there were several Catholic slave owners. I don't have to tell you of the recent apologies that even those in the border states had to make. Georgetown University comes to mind immediately for owning slaves. Those sort of Catholic institutions that had very real involvement with the politics of the day, they had to let bygones be bygones. It was sort of incumbent upon them to be bridge builders. In a way, one wonders if there were no Catholics in the country, whether the Civil War would have continued or resolved itself in the ways that it did. Of course, that's it's kind of a sort of strange sort of speculation, but I think Sheeran most definitely, especially in his last experiences in the war, would have found a way to forgive.
I'd like to take us back to that, the Sheeran's experiences during the war, because he was a chaplain with units that were assigned to the Army of Northern Virginia. And so he was very much at the forefront of some of the most storied battles of the war. And you have these passages in which he is not just commenting upon his labors as a chaplain, but he's also describing the battles as he witnessed them. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that, you know, how it was that he came to have such a fortunate place and those experiences of being there at places like Second Bull Run, like Gettysburg, like Sharpsburg, and so forth.
Well, his unit, the 14th Louisiana, saw considerable action. And one of the unique things about this group of men, which came to be known as the Louisiana Tigers, or sometimes the Irish Tigers, so called for their ferocity in battle, the reason that they all gained this reputation was in part through Sheeran's ministrations. There is a kind of theory, and it was espoused actually by Jefferson Davis, that chaplains didn't amount to a hill of beans. They more or less got in the way of actual soldiering. But in Sheeran's book, and several of his men attest to this, the more you prepared a person for the prospect of their own imminent death, the easier it would be for them to engage the enemy. It sounds a little strange, but when the conscience isn't bothered, when you know that you have only your own self and the enemy between you and God, and it's thanks to your local priest, well, that makes for a very dangerous enemy. They have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And what's curious about Sheeran's presence among the Louisiana Tigers, you have lots of Louisiana units, but also other states, that had considerable casualties or deserters, but not Sheeran's unit. Very few casualties and almost no deserters. And again, in Sheeran's book, it's because he provided the sacraments to his men.
And that takes up another large portion of his diaries, which is his description of giving mass, administering last rites, tending to the spiritual needs, not just of the unit, but of all these other people that he comes across in these very wide-ranging travels that he undertakes as a result of this service.
This is actually a kind of interesting aspect of the journal itself. The journal, I have to say, is it's kind of a remarkable document. It's a two-volume 1,656 pages of manuscript, which we've condensed into 600-plus pages. The fact that he's able to move around the South so much and take in so much of the activities going on among ordinary citizens in the midst of the war, I think is one of the unique features of the diary. It'll really open up some new avenues of research. And I'll give you a particular example of that. When he was kind of on hiatus between the winter of 1863-64, he encountered a man named Gleason, who he knew from New Orleans, but who was serving in the Confederate legislature in Richmond, Virginia. And Gleason had his family with him, including a daughter. And Sheeran was quite chummy with this man, and so suggested to Mr. Gleason that if he would consent, Sheeran would take the daughter on a road trip. And they went through with Gleason's consent, they went through several southern cities. So in addition to Richmond, they went off to Charleston, to Savannah, Dalton, Georgia, down to Mobile, and then back to Richmond, all within the space of a few months. But they got to witness what life was like in these areas. And the curious thing for me is, what about the children in the diaspora? Here you have a young lady in the company of this priest, and everything was totally above board there, traveling around the South in the midst of the war. What an education for that young lady. But that kind of social history is usually lost when you look through much of the Civil War literature. We don't usually get the perspective of what it might be like for teenagers, for instance, and their experience of the war. But Sheeran sort of lets that through. It's a very unique window on what life was like back then.
We should add that this is not the first time that these diaries have been edited, but as you describe, the previous efforts have really been much constrained. They don't really capture the depth of Sheeran's passages. They are much more pruned down and don't give quite the same flavor that you have in his text. He made some interesting choices in terms of preserving a lot of his original spellings and so forth. You make them clear for us as readers, but they really do give a sense of Sheeran as a person, as an author on his own, and not just somebody who's a very detached observer.
Well, Father Sheeran, he is a kind of special individual. When his diary was first unearthed, this was in the 1950s, some of the Redemptorist priests who had known that the diary existed asked the provincial of the Redemptorists at the time, you know, might we publish this? And the provincial had no objection, but now the question was, who do we get to publish it? So by 1960, they had landed on a very good Civil War historian, a Jesuit father from Georgetown University, Father Durkin. And Durkin took one look at the manuscript and knew the value of it. But he said, no one will read the whole thing. We have to excerpt it. So the Redemptorist said, that's a good idea. We're going to leave it in your hands and run with it. So in 1960, Father Durkin published his excerpts with commentary. And, you know, if you go through those excerpts, they're great little nuggets. And Father Durkin's commentary is very lively. But you get the sense that there's more Durkin in there than there is Sheeran. So about 10 years ago, Redemptorists were gathered around a meeting of people who study the history of Redemptorist life in the United States. And a few of them said, you know, that Durkin version of the Sheeran Journal, maybe we should publish the whole thing. Well, 10 years later, and after several meetings about it, and one little addition, we think that Father Sheeran was perhaps dyslexic. And so yours truly had to edit maybe 40,000 or so individual places in the journal where there were kind of obvious errors and even not so obvious errors. So what you have now is a very clean text, but also one that's the whole thing. It really lets his voice shine through. And my commentary is very minimal. So that was our plan, you know, get the whole thing out and let people judge for themselves.
You've already cited a few episodes that are recorded in the diary that illustrate particular points about Sheeran and his experience of the war. I was wondering if there was another one, a passage or an event that is described over a few passages that was of special interest to you or that you found to be a moment which was especially revelatory about Sheeran and his experiences with the war.
You know, I did. As I mentioned at the outset, I'm from the North, and my people fought in the Civil War, just as Southerners fought for their cause as well. The difference, though, in the way I was taught was we were the victors. But going through this diary, I have to say that no one was really the victor, because people lost their lives, and it was not lost on Father Sheeran in saying so. But throughout the diary, you get the impression that this very haughty, arrogant priest, one who could really get away with just about anything, had finally gotten his comeuppance when he was packed off as a prisoner of war to Fort McHenry in Baltimore. But just prior to that, he did something that has sort of redeemed him in my eyes. After one of the last battles that he witnessed, he asked his commanding officer if he could cross a road into enemy lines and minister to the wounded on the other side. And this commanding officer, knowing Sheeran's reputation, said, "Father, if you can get across, you're welcome to go visit our men, but I cannot protect you once you cross that road." So he was issued the pass, off he went, and almost immediately after he crossed the road, he was captured. He immediately told his captors, "Boys, I'm a Redemptorist priest. Take me to your commanding officer." So he went to go see General Wright. And Wright was not a small player in the war, but granted Sheeran the permission that he sought to go minister in the hospitals to the wounded. And Sheeran did ministry to both sides there, not only the Confederate, but also the Federals. And while he was in enemy lines, he encountered a man named James Mulligan. And Colonel Mulligan was kind of a famous Catholic. He had started a Catholic newspaper in Chicago. But when Sheeran encountered him, he was laying mortally wounded. And he stayed with him. During the course of his last moments, he gave him the last sacraments, and he stayed with the body until Colonel Mulligan's widow arrived on the scene. And Sheeran admits that even this this enemy, who he knew to be an enemy, was nevertheless in his last moments a very pious and upstanding man. And I think that kind of change of perspective, of going from someone who's the enemy and who should be reviled, to someone who is just like me, someone trying to be a good, upstanding person, that really opened my eyes to the possibility of repairing what had been a disastrous 4 years.
So, if he had this pass, how did he end up incarcerated?
Well, the pass only went so far. Word leaked out that there was a gentleman, a priest, who was administering aid and comfort to the enemy in the federal hospitals. Well, word got back to General Philip Sheridan that this was going on, and General Sheridan was no fool. He had already been burned once by a Jesuit who was sort of playing double duty between the federal side and the Confederate side. He was not going to let another priest get the better of him. And so when he learned of Father Sheeran's activities, he had him arrested and sent to Fort McHenry. So the amazing thing to me about his incarceration at Fort McHenry is the fact that he was able to write letters and get them out of the prison. As a prisoner of war, he was stashed in a horse stable. And so he writes from stable number one, Fort McHenry, Maryland, to his friend and former classmate, James McMaster. Now, McMaster was an editor in New York. He ran the New York Freeman's Journal, a Catholic newspaper. And McMaster was incensed that Sheridan, who was also Catholic, could incarcerate a Catholic priest simply for doing his job, especially with the kinds of characters that were also considered prisoners of war, and the fact that he was incarcerated in a horse stable and totally susceptible to the elements. This was in the winter of 1864. McMaster was livid. He printed Sheeran's letters in total, about four of them, each time offering a commentary about how the Union was going to fall simply because it had incarcerated the best of the South. So in any case, the PR that was generated over this episode was just too much for Washington to bear. Somehow word must have gotten to General Sheridan to release Father Sheeran before he caused any more damage. And so in the last week of December, a series of conferences between Sheeran and Sheridan take place so that in early January, he's kicked out the door. Now, by this time, poor Father Sheeran had his health broken and begged for money for the ferry, which he used to cross the bay in Baltimore to the nearest Redemptorist parish. And there he collapsed into the arms of one of its brothers.
You conclude the excerpts of the diary with a passage from April 24th, 1865. And I think it's a great inclusion because it really does reflect, I think, very nicely the fact that while Sheeran's health may have been broken and his cause may have been lost, his views about the war had not changed. And he's describing how he's setting out for New York and how New York is in mourning for Abraham Lincoln, and he's rather contemptuous of this. But there's that great line in there that about how that the remains are now passing to his former home in the West, which it would be well for the country had he never left.
Right. I have to say. Sheeran was no fan of President Lincoln, and the fact that the funeral bear that brought him up the East Coast and then out to Illinois, Sheeran's same path tracked exactly with Lincoln's funeral cars. So in Philadelphia, for instance, where I am now, the church where Sheeran stayed just for a couple of days as a way to recuperate, but also as a kind of way station on his way to New York. The church where he stayed, the steeple was draped in black bunting. And so Father Sheeran, witnessing this, thought it was a kind of desecration of the church. He made his politics well known, and he was more than happy to leave Philadelphia for New York, where he found much the same thing.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, sure. A couple of things. The parish of St. Peter the Apostle, where the shrine of St. John Newman is located. Newman is the first Redemptorist saint in the United States, the first male saint, former Catholic Bishop of Philadelphia. St. Peter's is undergoing its 175th anniversary this year, and I'm writing the parish history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a fascinating project. Lots of hands contributing, but I'm sort of shepherding this through, and that'll be out in the fall, we hope. But then a more long-term project is something not redemptoristic solely. It's the biography of Patrick Cardinal Hayes of New York, who I am not named for, nor am I a relative of him. Cardinal Hayes was the Archbishop of New York in the 1920s and 30s. And that has been a fascinating project because you get to see the city transform itself in very interesting ways. And its Catholic population had a huge hand in that.
Well, I hope we can have you back when your biography of Cardinal Hayes comes out, because it sounds like an excellent, a fascinating project.
Well, there's no end to church history, so I'm glad to make my little contribution.
Well, it's not as little as you're making out to be. It's an excellent diary, and it really is, as you say, it opens up a fascinating window into part of the Civil War that you don't oftentimes think about.
Well, I'm glad you could have me on. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and have a wonderful day.